You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM HD, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and on the web at kfai.org. For the next 60 minutes, you'll be hearing The Wave Project, KFAI's weekly community access hour. If you'd like to produce your own one-hour radio program, information on applying can be found at kfai.org/waveproject. The views expressed on this program are those of the persons expressing them and do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of Fresh Air's Incorporated Board of Directors, volunteers, or staff.
Good morning and welcome to The Wave Project. My name is John Irvin and I am a filmmaker, writer, and most importantly for this broadcast, Fringe Festival producer. And the name of my latest live production for the 2026 Minnesota Fringe Festival is Turn On, Tune In, Drop Dead. Before the Sex Pistols, there was Led Zeppelin with Communication Breakdown. Turn On, Tune In, Drop Dead is my sixth production as writer, producer, director, and occasional cast member for the Minnesota Fringe Festival. This one-act comedy, which will have five performances at the Rarig Center's Soul Thrust Theater between August 6th and 16th, is framed around a television debate. This debate, mind you, is not between two political candidates, but life forms that are almost as terrifying, two incarcerated serial killers. This verbal blood feud is held at a maximum security facility in beautiful Spooner, Wisconsin, and is moderated by a prominent true crime TV reporter in the mode of true crime TV diva Nancy Grace. The killer debaters are likewise inspired by the innumerable real-life serial murderers who have terrorized their streets, homes, and highways. One, in fact, is a former long-haul trucker known as the Highway Slayer, though he prefers to be called the Roadkill Warrior. His opponent also used a vehicle to abduct and kill his victims. In this creature's case, it was a van laminated with icons for candy to lure the children of beautiful Ripon, Wisconsin. This led him to be called the Ripon Ripper. It's safe to say that both these Wisconsinites had approaches to love that were highly unusual.
It's not unusual. It's not unusual.
That was Belly with their cover of Tom Jones' It's Not Unusual. And like the first song I played on this broadcast, the original version of It's Not Unusual featured a up-and-coming guitarist named Jimmy Page. Moving on from the fictional terror caused by two of the three characters of my upcoming Fringe Festival show, I'll look back on the real-life terror caused by the thousand-strong thug force known as Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. This goon squad would find themselves not only confronting ice, snow, and temperatures many of these good old boys and gals had never experienced before, the various forms of civil resistance they never imagined in their moonshine-soaked noggins. I would be part of some of the larger marches and confrontations that made these little green men and women and the little orange man who sent them here regret they ever messed with the land of 10,000 protests. We embodied Norman Mailer's armies of the night, except this cold, frigid January evening in downtown Minneapolis, our army was encased in parkas, bearing signs in our mittened hands demanding the removal of the camo creeps. We marched from the Hennepin County Government Center to Washington Avenue, down Washington Avenue, past twinkling bistros and wine bars, over to the Leviathan of the U.S. Bank Stadium. Fronted by a cheerleader blessed with a powerful microphone and an even more powerful voice, he led us in chants that blended old favorites like This Is What Democracy Looks Like with new hits like Fascism Out Now. We wound up at a park just in front of the stadium, looking magnificent in the wintry night as a melding of the Titanic and one of the icebergs that led to its undoing. Following the first of two murders of local citizens that made ICE the world's public enemy number one, I took part in a sub-zero press pool. This outdoor media frenzy centered around a confrontation between 100 or so outraged locals and a phalanx of masked, uniformed, and paunchy dragoons bearing semi-automatic weapons at the entrance to the parking lot of the Whipple Building near Fort Snelling. Fort Snelling, this iconic historical site, was likewise once a temporary detention center for fellow citizens dragged out of their homes. My activity this time around consisted mainly of taking photos of the many news reporters and media people capturing the rabble hosing ICE down with put-downs. The most notable of these rousers was a rotund man with a Teddy Roosevelt mustache and granny glasses who was in the midst of a nonstop rant at the marauders. What caused me and most of the news cameras to immortalize him was not so much what he said, but what he wore. His massive bearish girth was adorned in a bright pink fur coat that suggested he would not only knock heads in a demonstration, but knock him dead on a fashion runway. This gentleman was even featured on an episode of The Daily Show. I, in my black winter jacket, black backpack, holding my black phone in my black gloved hands, can be seen lurking behind this feather boa rough rider, making my debut on international television as this Gopher State Peacock's one-man paparazzi. We'll be right back. David Bowie, of course, with Fashion, and that song always sounds like fascism. Anyway, maybe that was the intent. Okay, following the winter of ice discontent, I flew to the windy, rainy, chilly, but politically warmer climes of Edinburgh, Scotland for a week's visit. It was the 50th anniversary affair of sorts, being my first time trotting its sodden grounds. Since spending a few days there in 1976 with my parents and brother during a summertime tour of Europe, on my solo 2026 slog, I arrived in Edinburgh via a flight from Dublin on a plane powered by propeller, the first I have taken since I was 10 years old in Mexico, though that, I should say, was not on a drug run. Strangely, the mighty gales didn't affect this propliner, even when it flew over the wind farms that make the little orange man's hair stand on end. Among the points of interest I visited in the Athens of the North is the Palace of Holyrood House, an enormous two-level estate that once housed and imprisoned Mary, Queen of Scots. It continues to be used to this day as a getaway lodge by the royal family. As I toured the stately manse's massive dining rooms, bedrooms, privies, and reception halls, I could not help but wonder if Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, back when he was still Prince Andrew, used them to hold court for visiting sex traffickers. There was a time when Andy and Jeffrey and Jelaine and Donnie might have been locked up in the city's most iconic site, Edinburgh Castle. Edinburgh Castle does live up to its billing as a mighty citadel looking down protectively over the metropolis. But frankly, it is more impressive to gaze upon the stronghold from the outside, especially at night from the city below, than it is within its cold stone walls. The most impressive and unusual gallery I toured in the city below was the Surgeons' Hall Museum, dedicated to honoring advances in medicine for which Scotland led the way in the 1800s. One wing of this repository is filled with thousands of little jars containing preserved body parts in various states of decomposition, including enough eyeballs to inspire a Bobby V song or a Hannibal Lecter all-you-can-eat buffet. My entertainment needs were met mainly by street musicians, most of whom, clad in Highland dress, blasted bagpipes. In fact, on the Sunday I was there, the hills were alive with a skirl of sheep guts. As for red light nightlife, a strip club can actually be found not far from the Surgeons' Hall Museum. This location does make morbid sense, because the grim exotic dance emporium is named after Burke and Hare, the grave robbers who in 1828 provided bodies for the many local doctors conducting medical research. Graveyards, though, as innumerable books and movies have confirmed, were not their main source of provisions. These scoundrels found they could provide more freshly useful research subjects by murdering the poor souls themselves. God knows what fate awaits the dancers at the Burke and Hare Strip Club if they don't earn sufficient dole for the house.
They fall from your mouth, propelled by your belly and your tongue. I shiver when you say, and I fall into jelly. I think I loved you more. day when looking, but there's nobody who smells like him, who looks like him. You're not human to me. Are you human?
That was Goldfrapp with Human, and if they ever do revive the James Bond franchise, they really ought to have Goldfrapp do all of the theme songs for every entry of the new one. Anyway, another memorable voyage I engaged in during the first year of the second epoch of the Little Orange Man was my week in Florence, Italy in fall of 2025. The most beloved site for tourists, not to mention Dr. Lecter, is the Duomo, officially known as the Cathedral of Santa Maria del Fiore. Though I took endless amounts of photos of this behemoth, which looms over the surrounding streets like Godzilla, I never was able to see the monster's innards, thanks to the line of tourists and worshippers that seemed to be professionally camped out in the surrounding courtyard with all the dedication of pre-internet concert ticket buyers. However, I was willing to be a living statue in the far more manageable queue to get into the Palazzo Pitti and the attached Boboli Gardens, the enormous estate that was once ruled by the Medici dynasty, heaves with two levels of salons and apartments chock-a-block with statuary, figurines, and paintings from the Renaissance and beyond. Though I dined at a number of recommendable restaurants and cafes, favoring a tea room near a 24-hour merry-go-round in the Piazza della Repubblica, I avoided the many spots throughout the city that displayed huge slabs of meat turning on skewers like dead mafia snitches. Florence's nightlife no doubt sizzles like all that beef, but I only summoned the energy to boogie at one venue. This happened to be a cafe that, shall we say, rocked hard. This one had an enormous club with a stage for live music. I walked in just as that night's band was kicking off. I never caught their name, but they played smooth covers of Blondie, Tears for Fears, and other artists of the 70s and 80s, sung by an elegant, sparkly signora who looked like she frequented the roughly 10,000 stores in town that sell purses. And nothing but purses. Returning to daytime playtime, the most distinctive treasury I came upon was devoted to Franco Zeffirelli, a native of the city who was a Renaissance man in his own right, with a long career directing theater, opera, and film until his death in 2019. I prowled several galleries lined with shots of the director in action and the superstars who graced his movies, including Cher, Elizabeth Taylor, Faye Dunaway, and Ricky Schroeder. That last drizzly day offered a more convulsive head trip, courtesy of the Florence Biennial. Entitled Light and Darkness, over 500 artists, a number of whom were in attendance, offered paintings, statues, chairs, sinks, and cars, and various other objets d'art, I suppose that's how it's pronounced, that appeared to be dipped in espresso, chocolate, or blood. Tim Burton, yes, that Tim Burton, was not in attendance when I strolled through a wing dedicated to drawings and installations that were recognizable from his prolific career as a major Hollywood director. The highlight of Tim's playhouse was a ball suspended in the air, an electric current running through it like the one that ticked off Bela Lugosi, as played by Martin Landau, in a film dedicated to another cinematic artiste, Edward D. Wood Jr. Christine by Susie and the Banshees, and for some reason that song always reminds me of Tim Burton movies, and I guess Edward D. Wood Jr. movies. From travel, we go to the movies, specifically the first movie I ever rented on 16mm celluloid with projector and clanging components in the summer of 1979. The flick was the 1967 version of the James Bond adventure Casino Royale, which I leased over the course of a blazing hot weekend in August of that inflation-soaked year. I gave multiple screenings of this big-budget all-star fiasco in our mostly unair-conditioned house for family and friends. On that weekend's steamy Saturday, a teen titan computer tech whom I had known since the start of the previous academic year arrived, eager to see Casino Royale, of course, but more crucially sitting down for the first time to a picture show at someone's house that was not broadcast on television. Like me, this portly young man was a cinephile, frustrated at not being able to enjoy sought-after titles at any time of day. The urge struck him. Unlike me, the types of shadow plays he pined for lurked within the nether regions of hardcore pornography. A fan of Seika, or is that Sika, Marilyn Chambers, and other sensations of screens he was too young to set foot in theaters for, Mr. Saturday, as I'll call him, had to content himself with photo spreads and magazines purchased by his devoted mother. Since divorcing the boy's father some years before, Supermom, as I'll call her, indulged without complaint her only child's boundless appetites for porn, food, and especially guns. The Walther handguns, M9 bazookas, and detonation devices that turned Casino Royale into a battlefield certainly made Mr. Saturday laugh and applaud with abandon. But it was the provocatively attired starlets who, by the thousands, populate the sets and locations of this madcap Bond spoof that truly sent him, well, reeling. Even if they didn't engage in the kind of acrobatics that Seika, Marilyn Chambers, and their colleagues performed in the periodicals acquired by Supermom. This most enjoyable of my three home presentations of Casino Royale that sultry weekend in 1979 concluded with Mr. Saturday over the moon at what he witnessed with his bedazzled 14-year-old eyes, bounding out of my residential theater into the car Supermom drove him home in. I have no doubt that this 1967 filmed epic display of armory and femme fatality inspired a house party many years earlier. Later, that Mr. Saturday reportedly held as an adult at Supermom's house when Supermom was out of town. The guest list for this theme soiree was reportedly made up entirely of consenting women over the age of consent who were ready, willing, and able to reenact scenes from favorite nuggets of adult cinema, now available at the press of a remote on his and Supermom's time-tested VCR. Needless to say, Mr. Saturday was the only leading man allowed entree into his mother's house and soundstage.
Oh, programming support comes from the Backyard Blues Festival, Dual Citizen Brewing Company, and the Minnesota Blues Society. The 13th annual Backyard Blues Festival is back at Dual Citizen Brewing, located at 725 Raymond Avenue in St. Paul. The event begins Friday, August 7th at 6 p.m. with Toronto Cannon and the Butanes. The festival continues on Saturday, August 8th, beginning at 11 a.m. as a free all-ages event featuring 10 local and regional blues acts throughout the day. More information available at dcbc.com.
That was Wham Bam Thank You Ma'am by the Small Faces, and I'd like to think if Mr. Saturday actually did host this party, which frankly I doubt, he told his guests, Wham Bam Thank You Ma'am will boogie till the rooster crows. My experience in film exhibition led inevitably to my becoming a writer, producer, and director of movies in my own right, starting with my feature-length tribute to German Expressionism, Made in Berlin, which was brought to life on 16mm black and white celluloid. This was the first of seven completed features and shorts made over the course of 20 years. The 21st century saw the arrival of Vixen Highway, a road adventure I wrote and directed that was shot on the highways and wooded areas, small towns, and big cities of Minnesota, which was a feature-length tribute to midnight movie auteur Russ Meyer. My most eyebrow-raising work and my most popular stream on YouTube is 2003's Pro-Inhibition, a futuristic work set in the now not-too-distant year of 2050 that revolves around a drug rehabilitation center for the world's most critically important public servants, dominatrixes. Following two documentaries on the 2008 Republican National Convention and the Minnesota Tea Party, many of whose interviewees no doubt went on to make America great again, I returned to narrative cinema with two more features. Citizen Kane, the latter word of the title spelled C-A-I-N-E, is not an homage to Orson Welles, but the saga of a cocaine-addicted insurance salesman from St. Paul who travels to Hollywood in search of his missing daughter and plunders the depths of what else? The adult film industry. The Tiki War followed in 2014 and is my first flick set in the distant past, taking place in a tiki bar in 1961 Chicago on the eve of John F. Kennedy's inauguration as president. It focuses on a 3 a.m. after-hours battle over territory, honor, and heroin between rival nightclub owners who are expatriates from Batista-era Cuba. Since that era, I have focused on bringing life to film scripts on the stages of the Fringe Festival and attempting to launch movie productions of those scripts, including a Western set in 1870s Colorado and a four-part tribute to Satan. I'm currently writing a screenplay about a murdered philanthropist and sex trafficker based on, who else, Jeffrey Epstein. This project was partly inspired by a clerk at my local grocery store who informed me that a customer out of the blue informed her that her twin sister had been kidnapped by none other than Jeffrey Epstein. I asked the clerk how old this woman appeared to be. She guessed that she was in her 40s, which matches the present age range of most of Epstein's victim survivors. I then asked her if the patron was a regular whom I could quiz myself. The clerk said she'd never seen her before and she seemed to be from out of town. Finally, I asked if this customer was at all credible in relating what happened to her twin sister, who may or may not have been one of the women working with Congress to pass the Epstein Files Transparency Act. The shopkeeper at my local grocery store replied confidently, if not confidentially, well, she didn't seem crazy.
He said, Captain, I said, what?
He said, Captain, he said, what?
work, you get no pay. I've been to the east, I've been to the west, where the girls I like most are the ones undressed. Well, hello, Adam, where you been? I said, stand aside, cause I'm a feeling mean. I had a gun full of you and I'm a feeling bad, but you're an ugly old pirate and ain't I glad. He said, Captain, I said, what? He said, Captain, I said, what? He said, Captain, I said, what? He said, Captain, I said, what you want?
Captain Sensible with Watt, that's spelled W-O-T is the English. Spell it even though it's the same word. And that was inspired by the fact that somewhere on the internet is a picture of Jeffrey Epstein in a captain's hat. With that sickening image in mind, thanks for tuning in and turning on to my latest edition of The Wave Project. Turn on, tune in, drop dead. Turn on, tune in, drop dead is again the title of the production I am unveiling for the latest edition of the Minnesota Fringe Festival. My one-act play concerning a televised debate between two incarcerated serial killers and the true crime TV reporter who interrogates them will have five performances in the operatic hall, the Stoll Thrust Theater at Rarig Center. Showtimes and tickets for my production and all extravaganzas taking place at the 2026 Minnesota Fringe Festival between August 6th and 16th can be found at minnesotafringe.org. And the films described in this broadcast, including videos of past Fringe shows I've produced, can be found at the John Irvin page or channel on YouTube. That's J-O-H-N-E-R-V-I-N and on YOUTUBE. Once again, I'll just spell it out. JOHNERVIN channel on YouTube. Thanks for listening. And my final song of the show is a tribute to the church that is housing our rehearsals and graciously allowing us to kill people and swear and spit to our heart's delight. Here is Culture Club with Boy George and Church of the Poison Mind.
Thank you.
That was the theme to the James Bond adventure. Oh, sorry, that was Goldfrapp again with Utopia. And now here's Joe Boxers with their tribute to Mr. Saturday and his house party at his mom's house, Supermom's house. Joe Boxers with Just Got Lucky.
He was cut.